1 Corinthians 16 in summary. The 47th talk in a series on 1 Corinthians was presented by Ron Julian on September 19, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
In the distant past, in the hazy reaches of the past where few of us can remember, I started to teach on 1 Corinthians. And today is the last session in 1 Corinthians. Some sort of milestone. I'm not exactly sure what sort, but we are actually going to finish the book today. For those of you who are visiting, in a way, it's kind of too bad that you happen to hit today, because we're going to look quickly at chapter 16, which is the end of the letter where Paul deals with various issues. This is kind of the business end of the letter, in a sense. We've been talking about a lot of pretty fundamental theological things as we've gone through the letter. This is less that way than the rest that we've been looking at. So what I want to do this morning is I want to take us quickly through the chapter, make a few comments about what we find there, and then I would like to make a couple of comments about the book as a whole. I would like to sort of step back and draw a few conclusions from what we have seen over the years. Okay, so we're in chapter 16 of 1 Corinthians. Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I directed the churches of Galatia, so do you also. On the first day of every week, let each one of you put aside and save, as he may prosper, that no collections be made when I come. And when I arrive, whomever you may approve, I shall send them with letters to carry your gift to Jerusalem. And if it is fitting for me to go also, they will go with me. We see here evidence of what we see in several of the letters of Paul. He was in the process of making a collection for the church in Jerusalem from the various churches that he founded and that he went around and taught at. The money was for the poor in Jerusalem. It may be connected with what we see in Acts about the prophecy that there would be famine coming in Jerusalem, and they had already started to anticipate and collect for the needs that were going to develop there. I think also that Paul is trying to foster a connection between the largely Gentile churches that he founded and the Jewish church in Jerusalem. And it also, I think, shows that Paul wants to keep a connection between himself and the Jerusalem church. Remember the situation. The church starts in Jerusalem, the day of Pentecost. That's where the resurrection happens and the ascension and all of that. But Paul's ministry is largely unconnected with the ministry of the other apostles. He was called by Christ separate from the other apostles, and he describes in Galatians how he had actually relatively little contact with the other apostles, every now and again sort of touching bases to make sure they were on the same page, but largely he's operating on his own. So in Galatians, he describes this process, and he talks about how when he went to Jerusalem, the apostles there added nothing to him. And what he meant by that was he came with his gospel, with his message that he received from Jesus. He explained to them what it was he was teaching, what it was about, and they didn't correct him, is what he's saying. They didn't say, well, now, Paul, here's where you've gone wrong, or you aren't talking about this, and you need to say this instead. The message that he got from Jesus and was proclaiming, they were fully on board with. He says the only thing they asked of him is that he would remember the poor. And he said, that's what I was already doing and was already anxious to do. And so this is basically a part of his fulfilling what he told them in Jerusalem he would be doing, which is going to the other churches and asking them to collect up money to send to the poor in Jerusalem. He mentions here that it's on the first day of every week that he wants people to kind of save up and make this collection. People make a big deal out of this. It is one of the few places in the New Testament that gives some little hint that it was Sunday, the first day of the week, that the Christians were in the habit of getting together. Very little hint, and it could be interpreted in another way as well, but probably that's what was going on. It's interesting to note how Paul is giving them these instructions about the collection and to think about how it actually worked itself out in the future. In 2 Corinthians, we see Paul having to write a fairly lengthy sort of exhortation to them, reminding them to finish what they had started and warning them against covetousness and reminding them of the importance of what they were doing and basically telling them, you know, the folks in Macedonia have already collected a large amount of money and they're going to be coming through your way. And I just would hate, you know, I've been telling them, you know, about how you've been collecting up money and everything. I would just hate for them to get there and for you to be totally embarrassed because you haven't done it. So even here, we can see there's just a little bit of, with this issue as well, there are some in Corinth that are not quite on board with Paul. He says that he may go to Jerusalem with the money, and as we'll see in a second here, it's a little bit complicated how all this works out, but ultimately he does go to Jerusalem from Corinth. He leaves from Corinth, goes and visits them again, leaves from there, and ultimately makes his way back to Jerusalem, and that's where he was arrested and ends up going to Rome to make his appeal to Caesar. Now, in verse 5, he says, "But I shall come to you after I go through Macedonia, for I am going through Macedonia, and perhaps I shall stay with you or even spend the winter, that you may send me on my way wherever I may go. For I do not wish to see you now, just in passing, for I hope to remain with you for some time if the Lord permits. But I shall remain in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective service has opened to me, and there are many adversaries." Make a comment about his being in Ephesus at this time. He talks about the many opportunities that he has there. He was in Ephesus for some time, several years, if I remember correctly. But he speaks of the adversaries that he has there. In 2 Corinthians, he describes his time in Ephesus as being so difficult that he had passed the sentence of death upon himself. He basically thought it may come to my death right here in Ephesus. It was such a difficult place. We do see one story in Acts about the kind of thing that Paul ran into, where Demetrius the silversmith is upset because Paul is speaking in proclaiming Christianity. He's speaking against paganism, and Demetrius feels it's cutting into his profits, making things for the pagan market, essentially. So there's a near riot that starts, and Paul very nearly gets into a great deal of trouble there. Evidently, this sort of thing was not uncommon in Paul's experience in Ephesus. Now, I want to make a comment about his travel plans here. It may seem sort of mundane. I mean, this was a long time ago. Who cares, you know, if Paul went through Macedonia to see the Corinthians or whatever. But it's actually sort of interesting as we look at the life of Paul and how difficult his relations were with the Corinthians. What he says here is that he plans to go around through Macedonia, and he wants to not just visit them briefly, but he wants to stay with them for a while. Now, if you picture the geography, we have the Mediterranean Sea, and we have this bump of water up on the top, which is the Aegean Sea. We have Asia, Ephesus, on the east. And on the other side of the Aegean Sea, we have Greece, where Corinth is. Macedonia is up above Greece. So where Paul is in Ephesus, there are two ways to get to Corinth. He can cross the sea directly across from Ephesus to Corinth, or he can take the land route around the shore of the Aegean Sea and come around through Macedonia up here and then down to Corinth. So what he says is, what I'm planning to do, I want to go to Macedonia. So what I'm planning to do is go up or take the land route, go through Macedonia, and then come down and stay with you for a while in Corinth, and then I'll leave the area from there. If I go to Jerusalem, then I'll go to Jerusalem from there. And wherever I end up going, I'll stay with you for a while. Things didn't work out quite the way he planned here. I mean, ultimately, well, you'll see. The key to what he's saying here, he says, I don't want to just come and visit you for a little bit. I'd like to come and stay with you for a while. But evidently, as we read what happened in 2 Corinthians, it didn't work out this way. Paul ended up with a serious problem between himself and the Corinthians, something that motivated him to take a quick, direct route across the sea and make a short visit to them to deal with some problem that had come up, and then go back to Ephesus again. So he was not planning to do that. He was planning to leave Ephesus eventually and take the land route around, go to Macedonia, and then come down to Corinth. But instead, he had to take this trip across, and he refers to this visit as his sorrowful visit in 2 Corinthians, where he left them sorrowful because he basically came and chewed them out royally over something. Something was bad, and he had to go and deal with the problem. So at that time, he tells them evidently, here's what I've decided to do now. I want to go to Macedonia, but what I'll do is I will come back from Ephesus. I'll cross the sea again, and I'll come see you guys, and then I'll go up the land route to Macedonia, and then I'll come back again and visit you again. So I'll visit you twice to make sure that we get plenty of opportunity to interact here. Somewhere in there, he tells them that that's what he's going to do. But as we see in 2 Corinthians, he doesn't end up doing that. He ends up going back to his old plan of taking the land route around. And his opponents in Corinth really get on his case. Paul, you liar. You said you were going to come across and see us and then go up to Macedonia and then come down again. But that's not what you're doing. Just more evidence of how unreliable you are, Paul, as a person. And Paul has to explain to them, look, is this what you think? I mean, I just, like any normal human being, I just do what I want and I don't pay any attention to what you want or anything like that. I'll tell you why I didn't come across is because of the way things were left between you and me the last time. I didn't want to come and have another visit like the one that we had the last time. So he had sent Titus to Corinth to basically check out the water and say, so how are we doing here? And so Paul takes the land route around the Aegean Sea so that he can meet Titus coming back the other way and find out from Titus, so how are things going here? Can I go or not? And he reports, I was very happy to hear from Titus that we would have to say at least some of those in Corinth were really sorry about the way things went last time, and they were really repentant, and they really wanted Paul to come, and so he was happy, and he ultimately did go to Corinth. Just a simple idea of the travel plans that he has in going there actually is involved in this intrigue that is going on between Paul and the Corinthians, that there is a significant sector in the church that really is hostile to Paul, and it just shows up in all kinds of different ways. So even what he says here about what he plans to do, this goes back and forth because of the relationship that he has with them. In verse 10, he says, now whenever Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause to be afraid, for he is doing the Lord's work, as I also am. Let no one therefore despise him, but send him on his way in peace, so that he may come to me, for I expect him with the brethren. When we look at the difficulty of the relationships between Paul and the Corinthians here, we can see that this takes on a little more weight. When Timothy comes, see that he is with you without cause to be afraid. Paul is concerned, actually, that at least some in Corinth, out of their hostility to Paul, will mistreat Timothy, who is very closely connected with Paul in his ministry, I think. I think this is more than just don't despise him because he's a young man or that sort of thing. I mean, there is that kind of issue. But I think Paul is concerned about what sort of reception Timothy will get from them. And He's saying, send him on his way in peace. Don't let him be afraid. He is doing the Lord's work. We don't know, but we would have reason to suspect that things didn't go so well when Timothy got there, because the sorrowful visit is still coming. I mean, Timothy is going to go there, and Paul is going to end up going over and having to chew them out. So the odds are that Timothy didn't do so well when he showed up there, although we don't have much other evidence to say. Okay. But concerning Apollos, our brother, I encouraged him greatly to come to you with the brethren, and it was not at all his desire to come now, but he will come when he has opportunity. If you remember back in the dim recesses of history, when we started 1 Corinthians, the first major section of the book deals with the factions that have grown up. And what we saw is that there is a party in Corinth that was anti-Paul. And in their anti-Paulness, they were pro-Apollos. They thought Apollos was cool and Paul was not cool. Well, this is interesting just to note that Paul doesn't ultimately get down on Apollos. In that section, he does kind of give Apollos a sort of a warning about how he ought to conduct himself, and there's kind of a gentle sort of admonition to him, I think, in that section. But fundamentally, they're okay. Apollos is with Paul now, and Paul is encouraging him to go back. And it is interesting, we can't say for sure, but Apollos is saying, no, I don't want to go back. And Paul's saying, okay, maybe later when he has opportunity, he'll go back. I don't know. We can't say for sure, but it is interesting to speculate that the reason that Apollos doesn't want to go back is because he got in such a mess the last time he was there. I mean, he doesn't want to go back into that situation and stir up the more of the problem, perhaps. Maybe it's just, hey, you know, I'm busy. You know, I've got a novel I'm trying to finish, and I'll come to you when I'm done. I don't know. But it's possible. I mean, at least it is interesting in the light of the difficult relationship and the issue that Apollos got involved with here, that Apollos does not yet want to go back. Okay, so that's the part of the letter where Paul kind of talks about the various travel plans. Okay, I'm going to come and collect the collection, and Timothy's going to be coming through your way, and Apollos isn't coming right now. We come now then to his final exhortations and ending of the letter. He says to them, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, act like men, be strong, let all that you do be done in love. Be on the alert is one of the important admonitions in the New Testament. When I was a young Christian, I mentioned when we were looking at the stuff about resurrection in the last section that I was very interested in eschatology, in, you know, when is Jesus coming back and who's the Antichrist and all of that kind of stuff. And back then, when I saw that be on the alert, it was often in those contexts when it was talking about Jesus coming back. And the impression I got is that what it was saying is I need to be paying attention so that I can see the signs that Jesus is coming back. Be on the alert because, you know, when you see the Antichrist putting stuff on people's foreheads and stuff, then you need to be ready to go or something like that, which is not what this admonition means. I think when you see it in the various places that it shows up, the idea emerges pretty clearly, is that fundamentally we in this life, living in this age, as a part of this world, it's like we're doped. It's like we're drunk. It's like we're asleep. It is so easy to lose sight of what's really important and what's going on. It's so easy for us to let God drift out of our assessment of our lives. I mean, to think that life is about what I see in front of me. You know, solving my financial problems, getting some success in my business, finding somebody to marry, and, you know, all of those sorts of things, those are the great preoccupations of our lives. And yet the fact is that everything we gather is going to burn, and we're going to face the judgment seat of God, and all of the things that we manage to accomplish in this life ultimately are going to go away, and we're going to have to face something more fundamental. Being on the alert means being awake, being ready, being aware. Don't let yourself be seduced by the world around you into thinking that this is all there is and that there is no bigger issue to deal with. Stand firm in the faith, he says. It is so easy for us in the pressure of the things around us to drift from the faith. We might not be aware that we're doing it. Paul's opponents in Corinth, I would argue, would call themselves Christians and see themselves as defenders of the faith. And yet, in fact, they are drifting away from it. And people in the church are starting to listen to them and being carried along with them. He's urging them to remember what the faith is. What is it that's true? What is it that fundamentally is going on in the world? Who is God? And who am I? And what is life about? Is life about? And stand firm in it. Don't be pushed off of it. Don't be seduced into another way of thinking about life, but stand firm in it. Act like men. I think the idea here is rather than being childlike and immature, we are to be courageous. We are to take the stance in life that an adult man would take. That's the kind of the roots of the word. So fundamentally, he is calling them to courage. He is calling them to face into the pressures that are coming toward them in a way that is mature and strong. And he ends with the admonition, be strong. So together, this set of admonitions here, I think, is all about what's been happening in the Corinthian church. That there are those who basically have let various worldly values call them to something different than the gospel that Paul has been preaching. And this is his last admonition to them. Stand firm. Be strong. Face the pressures that are coming at you in a courageous and mature way. Be alert. Be awake. Remember what's at stake. That's what he wants them to do. He ends by saying, let all that you do be done in love, which is one of the great essential values of the faith, one of the key truths that we face as believers is, as a creation of God, made in the image of God, with other people made in the image of God, we are called to love. We are called to love each other, to care about each other as much as we care about ourselves. And we are called to love God as well. I'm going to talk more about that in a minute. Paul here is, in this last little sentence, is taking his opportunity to remind them there is something great at stake. Remember what is at stake and hold fast to it. Don't let yourself be carried away into something else. Because ultimately, your eternal destiny is at stake in all of this. He says, now I urge you, brethren, you know the household of Stephanas, that they were the first fruits of Achaia, and that they have devoted themselves for ministry to the saints, that you also be in subjection to such men and to everyone who helps in the work and labors. And I rejoice over the coming of Stephanas and Fortunatus and Achaicus, because they have supplied what was lacking on your part. For they have refreshed my spirit and yours. Therefore, acknowledge such men. All I want to say about this section is, notice here, this is essentially an admonition. Again, in a very contentious church where there is a lot of opposition to Paul and to his message and to his authority in particular, here's Paul saying, look, here's Stephanas. He's one of the early leaders in the church. He's devoted to the ministry of the saints, and you ought to acknowledge him. You ought to submit to him. In this environment where there are all of these factions growing up, and this group says, oh, we don't have anything to do with Paul. We think Apollos is cool. And this group over here is saying, well, no, we don't think any of them are cool. We just follow Jesus. We don't listen to any of these guys. And all of this stuff that's happening, you have an environment, presumably, where Stephanas, as a leader who presumably, since he's being endorsed by Paul here, would see Paul's message as right, would acknowledge Paul's authority as an apostle, and is trying to help Paul teach and promote that message in the church. Presumably, Stephanas is having a tough time, that there are a lot of people there who are not listening to him. He's having a hard time being a minister in that situation because of the volatile environment. So here's Paul admonishing them, look, submit to him. Recognize who he is and what he's doing and the appropriateness of what he's doing and go along with it. So again, I think, this is not just little mundane chatter at the end of the letter. This is further evidence that there is something brewing in Corinth. And of course, if you've ever read 2 Corinthians, you recognize that ultimately this whole thing just boils over and there is a really difficult encounter between Paul and the Corinthians. If you read the last part of 2 Corinthians, that is the most biting and sarcastic and cutting comments that you will ever see Paul make in any of his letters. It's hard to read sometimes. I mean, it is a direct, in-your-face challenge to his opponents in Corinth. So this is a tough situation into which he's writing. Okay, he ends with the final goodbye of the letter. The churches of Asia greet you. Aquila and Prissa greet you heartily in the Lord, with the church that is in their house. All the brethren greet you. Greet one another with a holy kiss. The greeting is in my own hand, Paul. If anyone does not love the Lord, let him be accursed. Maranatha. The grace of the Lord Jesus be with you. My love be with you all in Christ Jesus. Amen. And again, I just want to make a few comments about this ending. You're probably familiar with this in several of Paul's letters. You see that at the end. The greeting is in my own hand. And Paul, this is where Paul has actually written out his name, which is further evidence that Paul didn't actually handwrite out these letters. He dictated it to someone, to an amanuensis. He sometimes mentions specifically who it is that is writing out the letter for him. In one of his letters, he says, "See with what large handwriting I have written this," which some people have taken to be evidence that there was some physical problem that Paul was dealing with, perhaps his eyesight, that he couldn't see very well. So he couldn't write himself, he had to dictate, and when he did sign it, it was really big because that's the only way he could see what he was doing. Something like that was going on. He makes this comment, if anyone does not love the Lord, let him be accursed, which sounds very harsh, and I think we might want to take just a minute to talk about what is he doing there. First of all, we have to understand that for Paul, how we respond to Christ ultimately is the touchstone for what our priorities and values are ultimately with God. Where are we coming from? Now, not in a trivial way. Obviously, there are many people in Corinth who have named the name of Jesus that Paul ultimately is going to say, you need to examine yourself and see if you're in the faith at all. So it's not the fact that I have said, yes, I'm a Christian, that is the touchstone. But ultimately, how I respond to the teaching of Jesus, to the salvation that he has promised, everything that goes along with Jesus, that God exists, that Jesus is the Messiah, that I am a sinner and I need to be forgiven, and Christ offered his life on my behalf so that I would be forgiven, and that life ultimately is to be found in the kingdom of God where Jesus rules over all creation. All of that, that's a part of this picture that either that's going to make sense to me and I'm going to say, yeah, okay, that's right, that's what I want, that's what I'm looking for, that's what I believe, or else life is about something else other than that. So When he says those who love the Lord, I think by the Lord here, Paul usually means Jesus when he says that. So he's talking about Jesus. And the idea is it's one last sort of reminder that there is something fundamental at stake here. How are you going to respond to Jesus and his message and his call and what it is he has taught and what it is he has promised? He says, if someone does not love the Lord, let him be accursed. The word here is the word anathema. And accursed may not quite capture what it means. When something is anathema, it is something that is forbidden. You stay away from it. That's anathema. And we use that. Sometimes you hear people use that word in English today. No, we're not going to do that. That's anathema, we would say, if you've ever heard people use the word that way. I think what Paul is trying to get across here is he's trying to say to the Corinthians, look, there is this difference between being a believer and not being a believer. He's been talking about that through the letter. In places, he's been very specific and explicit about what's at stake. And there is no room to kind of fudge and blur the line. Well, you know, we're all good people or something along those lines. There are those who see in the message of Christ and the work of Christ and the person of Christ what they need in their life. And there are those who think, no, I need something else. What Paul's trying to say to them here is either you love the Lord, which means you see in him your salvation and your teacher and your king, he is what it's about, or you don't. And what I'm saying to you is those who do not love the Lord are anathema. That is, you can't welcome them in and say, sure, come along in with us. Yeah, you know, you think that something else is true other than Jesus is the Messiah, but, you know, we like you, you're a good guy, I think we'll have fun together or something like that. We already saw throughout the letter that Paul had to warn them about drawing a line and saying there is a difference between being a believer and not being a believer, and you can't just open the doors and say, sure, we're all in this together. I think that's the kind of thing that he's trying to say to them here one last time. Look, there is something important at stake here. You need to love the Lord, and you need to recognize that those who do not love the Lord are not with you in this. When we see the language accursed, it makes it sound like if I respond to non-Christians by going around calling down curses on them or something like that. That's not what Paul's getting at. Paul is calling them to love. He goes out and proclaims the gospel out of love for people. He exercises his freedoms. When he's with Jews, he doesn't exercise the freedom that he feels to live like a Gentile because he loves them and he wants to have the opportunity for them to hear the gospel and so on. So he's not going out there calling down curses on everybody in that sense, but he is saying, look, there is this difference. The fact is that you as a church cannot say, you can't just open the doors and say, oh, we're all in this together. The fact is there are those who love the Lord and there are those who don't. And it's very important that you not blur the distinction. It's important that you not blur the distinction in yourself. Ultimately, you have to decide, do I love the Lord or do I not? Is Christ and his offer of salvation and the work that he did to bring that salvation and what he taught me about what life is all about and the kingdom that he is going to bring into the world, is that true? Is that what I want my life to be about? Is that what I long for? Is that what I love? That he is the one who teaches me and saves me and loves me and brings me into life? Is that what I love? Or is it something else I love? I have to make that choice. Maranatha, you may be familiar with that phrase. It's an Aramaic phrase that Paul has not translated. And it means probably, our Lord, come. It's like a prayer. Basically, it is looking forward into the future, recognizing that Jesus is going to return and saying, come, asking him to come. Which makes a great deal of sense to me. And I don't know about you, but I don't use the word Maranatha much, but it is not infrequent that from my heart I cry out to God, could Jesus come back now, please? So I think it's something that Christians throughout history have been praying. All right, so there's the end of the letter. Like I say, a mixed bag, a series of business propositions that he has to deal with a few admonitions along the way. I'd like to finish up, as I said, by making a few comments about the book, about this letter to the Corinthians that Paul wrote. Two things in particular that I want to talk about. Two reflections, I guess, on what we've seen. First reflection is, I think that the book of 1 Corinthians is a great book to practice on and to recognize what's at stake and how we ought to approach the Bible when we're trying to understand it. Most of us, I think, are familiar with the admonition that we should not pull verses out of context. And I think most of us would say, yeah, that's right. I mean, you'd be hard to find a Christian who would say, no, I believe in pulling verses out of context. But what we say we believe and what we actually practice, in fact, often ends up being different. And 1 Corinthians is a textbook case for how that difference can manifest itself. 1 Corinthians is filled with verses and paragraphs that, if you don't stop to look at the overall argument that Paul is making and try to put them into that argument, you end up going the wrong way and you misunderstand what it is Paul's getting at. I'm making a fairly substantial claim here. I mean, I want you to understand how serious I am about this. It's a fork in the road. You're going to go this way or you're going to go this way. If you are at all familiar with some of the popular teaching that you might find on 1 Corinthians out there, you will have noticed over the years that at a number of points I have disagreed with what it is you might hear about what goes on, what 1 Corinthians is saying. And in each of those cases, fundamentally, it comes back to the same issue. Yeah, if I just take this verse or this collection of verses and read it as if they were floating in space, I could make them go this way. And it might even sound like they're going that way. But if I actually step back and look at the argument, look at how it all fits together, I can see that they're only just a step in an argument, and what's important is the argument itself. And that it's often pointing in a very different sort of direction when you put the whole thing together. So we've seen this over and over again. In the first section of the book, there's a number of things like that. Paul starts out by saying, I don't want there to be factions among you. And so we run with that and say, yeah, see, what Paul wants is unity. And you know what divides us? Theology divides us. We need to kind of back up and just let everybody, as long as you love Jesus and you say amen whenever Jesus gets spoken, let's not get on this theology kick because that divides people, and what Paul wants is for us to be unified. Well, when you actually go and look at the argument and what Paul is concerned about in that section, that perspective makes no sense at all. What Paul is really concerned about is the spirit and values that have led to that division. Remember, fundamentally, this division is some of the people in Corinth have rejected Paul and his authority. He's not just sad because they're not getting along. He wants them to remember the truth of the gospel, which he proclaims, and to come back to that truth. In other words, he is greatly preoccupied with theology. He wants theology to unite them, because he wants them to remember what the gospel actually is and all get together around it. And he's particularly concerned about the worldly values that have led them to dismiss him in the first place. We come across a famous statement like, we have the mind of Christ. And that, I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard that. People run with that. As a Christian, I have been given the mind of Christ. Christ's mind is in me. I don't really need to worry so much about trying to understand the Bible, because if I just seek to find the mind of Christ that is in me. He'll tell me what it says, or, you know, all of those sorts of things. Well, I'm not going to rehearse all of this stuff again, but when you go back and look at the whole context of what Paul's saying there, I would argue that there's something very different in mind, that Paul's not making a statement about what Christians have in their mind or anything like that. He's saying something very different. He has the famous section where he talks about if any man builds on the foundation with wood, hay, and stubble, and so on. And that, you know, throughout my experience as a Christian, I have been taught from that passage about this is about rewards, and I lay a good foundation by believing in Jesus in my life, but, you know, I'm not going to get rewards unless I go on to build on that foundation by doing good works. Well, again, when we look at the context and the whole flow of thought and how it contributes to Paul's argument, that's not what he's talking about at all. That is far, far from the issue that Paul has in mind. The first four chapters of 1 Corinthians, I would argue, cannot be understood if we don't recognize that they're all part of one issue. The whole first four chapters, it looks like he's going from topic to topic to topic to topic, but in fact, if you pay attention, you can see that they're all about one thing, and you can't really understand it unless you see that one thing that it's about. Chapter 7 is often read as if it is fundamentally Paul's message to the church that marriage is second best. Well, when you put the whole argument together there, though, I think we see that the issue is a very specific one that Paul's speaking to in chapter 7, that there is a group in Corinth who has decided that sexuality cannot be spiritual. Obviously, sexuality is physical and carnal, and the truly holy person can't really involve themselves with sexuality. Therefore, even married people in Corinth, partners in a marriage, are deciding, I'm too holy for sexuality, and they're staying away from their spouse. And this is the situation into which Paul is speaking. Chapters 8 through 10 can be read as if they're a series of isolated ideas. Is it okay to eat meat sacrificed to idols? Yeah, but let's be careful about it. Hey, by the way, I, Paul, have the right to be paid. The Israelites fell in the wilderness, and you should flee idolatry. Well, when you stop and look at it, you can see that, in fact, chapters 8 through 10 are one section, again, and they're all part of one specific argument. The issue of eating meat sacrificed to idols has raised the problem of how I conduct myself in regard to my freedom as a Christian. They were free to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, but it was having a bad effect on some people. So the issue throughout the whole thing is how there are times when love calls upon us to limit our freedoms for the sake, especially for the sake of the gospel, for the sake of making it possible for other people to not be led astray and seduced into a misunderstanding or violating their own conscience and that sort of thing. And the whole section is about that. Chapters 12 through 14 are often seen, we recognize that they're about spiritual gifts, but we go picking for the ideas we like. Hey, there's a cool list of spiritual gifts. Which one did you get? See, there's the list, and let's see which one you got. Hey, and we're all part of one body. That's great. I think we should all love each other. Love is the best thing. Love is patient and kind. I saw it on a greeting card. And here are some rules for the order of events in a church service. Okay, so, you know, first, if you're going to have tongues, you do it this way, and you're going to have a prophet, you do it this way. Well, believe me, I've looked at commentaries on that section that treat those as if they're kind of isolated things that give us some nifty information about spiritual gifts. But again, if you look at the whole flow of the section, there is a rich and complex argument that Paul is making. He's trying to address a particular problem. And the problem is that some in Corinth have decided that speaking in tongues, because it's such an outward and flashy phenomenon, that speaking in tongues is the mark of spirituality. I'm spiritual because I do it, and you're not spiritual because you don't. That's the issue that the whole section, 12 through 14, is basically about. And in the section, Paul makes a series of arguments that speak into that issue. I'll say more about that in a second. Now, as I say, I'm making a profoundly important claim here. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I can be wrong in the profound importance of the claim. And he's speaking to those issues, and everything he says is meant to speak to those issues and to be part of an argument that he's making. We in the church have gotten in a very, very bad habit. I'm not saying that everyone has this bad habit. I could point you to commentaries on 1 Corinthians where I think the commentators are doing it right. They understand what ought to be happening, and they're trying to find that coherent argument. And I really admire those sorts of commentaries and people who teach from that sort of perspective. But I'm just telling you, look around in the church today, and what you will find is a lot of people who are teaching verses and paragraphs as if they were not a part of a larger argument, or who pay very little attention to that larger argument. The upshot of that is you can hear a lot of teaching from 1 Corinthians that I would say fundamentally you can go through the whole book and teach through the whole book, and in the end you have not taught what it is that Paul was trying to say. You've made a lot of points, some of which are true enough, some of which are not even true at all, and you have missed the point that Paul was trying to make. It's that serious an issue, I would argue. So I think for those of you who have hung in there over the long haul and have heard the sorts of things we've been saying about 1 Corinthians, I think you've seen some of what I'm talking about, that there are just these places where it makes a difference whether you're looking for that coherence or not. So the question that we all have to face is, where is the meaning of the text going to be found for me? Is it going to be found in whatever idea that comes into my head when I read the verse? Or is the meaning found in the argument that the biblical author is trying to make? And until I can find that argument, I haven't yet really found what it is that the author is trying to do. That is my assertion. And if I'm wrong about that, at least I have been consistent in teaching through 1 Corinthians. I have tried to model for you what I think that ought to look like. And I think 1 Corinthians is a great example of that sort of thing. And, of course, I don't think I'm wrong about that. In fact, I'm right about that, and you really ought to pay attention to this. Okay. My second reflection on 1 Corinthians is about the message of the book as a whole. In a way, it's hard to talk about the coherent message of the book because Paul speaks to a variety of issues through the letter. A few of those issues are not particularly contentious. That is, they don't seem to arise from a party that is fighting Paul or arguing something, saying we need to ignore Paul on this question. It's just genuine confusion that has arisen that Paul is speaking to. That issue about whether sexuality can be part of spirituality, I don't think that issue seems to have arisen from hostility toward Paul. It's a genuine misunderstanding, genuine confusion about what's going on. And Paul doesn't really get on their case in that particular section. He just gives them advice on how they ought to think about marriage and sexuality and how they ought to put all that stuff together. He addresses the confusion that has arisen about what women should do with their hair in the worship service because of the cultural signal that hair coverings and the way you wore your hair gave to in the culture. How are we going to think about that? And again, Paul does not seem to be dealing with hostility or opposition there. He's just saying, I know that you guys are trying to do what I said to do here. Now let me tell you how you ought to think about this in relationship to the idea of the headship of the husband and that sort of stuff. So those are just, from my perspective, are clarifying comments that still, they give us a lot of important information about how to think about sexuality, how to think about headship and that sort of stuff. But in a way, they're secondary kinds of issues. However, most of the letter that Paul has written to the Corinthians, the issues that he addresses find their roots in more fundamental problems. There is active hostility toward Paul. There is a group in Corinth that does not recognize his authority, does not particularly admire him, are trying to set themselves up as leaders, and on a variety of issues, they have basically taken it upon themselves to challenge one or more aspects of the gospel or the implications of the gospel. Now, let me just give you a brief picture of what I mean here. There are a lot of different ways of describing what's important for us as believers. I think that one of the ways we can describe it that can be very helpful is it is hugely significant that Jesus told us that there were two fundamentally important commandments: to love God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Loving God is in opposition to loving the world, I would argue. I'm going to love something. There's something that I'm going to be hot for, that I'm going to be, this is what I'm about, this is what I want, this is what I embrace, this is what I'm pursuing, this is my love. By nature, we all think that the things of this world are the things we ought to love and the things that are ultimately going to fulfill us. I must have whatever makes me happy and successful and prosperous now. I mean, every fiber of my being cries out to me, I've got to have that. This is what it's got to be. It's so easy for us to think that this is what it's about. What being a believer calls us to is to make room in our lives for God, which is like saying to make room in my phone booth for an elephant. I mean, it is when you make room for God, he takes over the room. But this is what we have been called to do. The fact is that God is actually there as opposed to not being there. He is actually good as opposed to being indifferent to me or evil. He can be trusted because he has made promises that are good and valuable, and he will keep those promises. When he tells me to do something, I ought to do it. He has commanded me to pursue goodness, and it is right for me to do so. This is what I have to make room for in my picture of the world, that God is actually there, and he is actually doing in history what he says he is doing, and the point of my life is actually what he says it is. That's what loving God ultimately brings me to, is to embrace everything that God is and has to say to me about what life is all about. That his understanding, his goodness, his promises, everything about him is what I want to be about. I want to think the way he does. I want to see the world the way he does. I want to receive what he has promised and all of that. Either we are learning bit by bit to see our lives as under God with an eternal hope in front of us, or we are blocking him out and saying basically, no, I'm in this room by myself, and I have to make the best of it that I can. Likewise, loving our neighbor, I think, is in opposition to our essential selfishness. By nature, we think our concerns are the most important, and the things that benefit us are the good things, and the things that benefit other people they're nice, especially if it can make me look like a good guy when they're getting it. We might not say explicitly that we are more important than everybody else, but we know it. We know that it's true. As believers, we must confront our own selfishness and admit that other people's concerns are just as important as our own. So these are the two great issues that confront us. They're the two great commandments. They are the two ways in which we have failed miserably as sinful human beings, and they are the two issues that, in a sense, we must confront as living out the life of faith. Now, loving God is very complicated. What has he promised? What is his character? And all of that. I mean, there's a lot involved in it. But fundamentally, the issue is, am I going to make room for God in my world, and am I going to make room for you in my world? Or in the end, am I at the center of the universe? That's the question that we face. I would argue that this is, fundamentally, in various ways, what Paul is confronting in the Corinthian church. He is confronting the problem of worldliness, a view of things that has pushed God de facto out of the picture. He's still being given lip service, but he's been pushed out of the picture. And the problem of selfishness, basically pursuing my own interests at the expense of others. In that first section, the divisions among them, we saw that at the heart of the problem was a worldly view of what is wise. The gospel is not cool among the sophisticated people of Corinth. Paul is not seen as a wise and sophisticated speaker and thinker. And so they say, you know, this is not cool. We need to back off on this Paul stuff a little bit. Paul's response is, it is stupid to let the world tell you what is wise. The world in its wisdom did not come to know God. How wise can a wisdom be that missed the most important person in all of reality? It can't be that perceptive if it missed God. The wisdom of the gospel is a rejection of the wisdom of the world, he's saying. You have to choose. You can be seen as hip and cool by the cool people of your culture, or you can embrace the gospel, but you can't have both because the world is going one way and the gospel is going another way. So which is it going to be? So in fact, Paul's concern about their divisions is not just that they're not getting along. The issue is, what do you think is true? Where is the true wisdom? He goes on then to deal with a problem of sexual immorality among them. There is a group in Corinth that is blasé about the fact that there's someone in their midst who is actively sexually immoral, and they're just embracing them and saying, sure, you're one of us, this is fine. Yes, my experience in this world tells me that sexual indulgence is fun. But will I acknowledge that there is a God who made me, who has a purpose for my sexuality? That my sexuality is a part of who I have been created as, and therefore it fits into the purpose of God for my life. And what makes sense for me is to go to Him to find out what place does it have in my life, and what should I do with it? There are those in Corinth who, although they pay lip service to God, fundamentally are not interested in God's perspective on sexuality. The issue of whether they ate meat sacrifice to idols. There is a sophisticated group in Corinth who knows rightly enough that they have the freedom to eat meat sacrificed to idols. And they're putting pressure on others that they would see as naive to join them. You know, that pressure of, oh, you're not going to be one of those kind of people, are you? You know, come on, come on. You should, there's nothing wrong with it. You join me in doing this. This is both worldly and unloving. Unloving because it is pressuring my fellow believers to violate their conscience. And that's one of the issues that Paul addresses there. Is it so important that you eat that stupid meat that you would be pressuring someone else to do what they believe is wrong? And worldly because it makes the right to eat meat more important than the gospel itself. Yes, there is this minor little implication of the gospel that if the gospel's true, then idols are nothing and you can eat the meat and it's no big deal. But that is a relatively trivial truth in comparison with the glaringly obvious truth that the gospel is true and that our call is to embrace the gospel and live faithfully before God so that we might enter into eternal life. That's what it's really about. And yet the sophisticates in Corinth have made it as if somehow exercising my sophisticated knowledge of my freedom is the height of my spirituality, and pressuring you to join me in sophistication is what's cool. Ultimately, Paul sees this issue as so important that it might actually be a make or break issue for the Corinthians. They might have actually fallen into such a disregard of God that they will in the end lose everything. He talks about spiritual gifts. As I said, some in Corinth have elevated the gift of tongues to the mark of spirituality, both worldly and unloving again. Worldly because it's very pagan to use flashy spiritual manifestations as proof of my spirituality. I mean, they learned this from their pagan background. Wow, this guy is writhing before the altar over here. There must be something really cool going on with him. The Corinthians have lost sight of what is most important to God. The true spirituality, he says, is having the eyes to see that Jesus is Lord and to actually embrace that faith and live it out. That's when the Spirit of God is at work, when you see faithful belief in the life of someone. That's where you see the real spirituality. Spiritual gifts, those have various purposes, and one person gets something and another person gets something else, and that has nothing to do with whether you are a child of God, whether you are a spiritual person or not. It's also unloving because of this, hey, I'm hot, and when are you going to join me sort of attitude. It's that you're not really with me unless you're as cool as I am sort of attitude. That has totally misunderstood what we as believers ought to be to each other. Finally, Paul goes to the section on the resurrection. And as we saw, it's not just an abstract theological problem. I think fundamentally, it is a worldly perspective. Their rejection of the idea of bodily resurrection amounts to a rejection of the idea that God is taking history to its culminating point. Basically, this life is what it's all about. But God's great plan, Paul says, is to redeem all creation and to rescue his people from sin and death. Resurrection is central because when you understand the story that God is telling, this is only a way station. This is only a stepping stone along the way to the grand culminating purpose of God. And if you reject the idea of bodily resurrection, then you have rejected the whole story. You have missed the point of where this is going. In general, many in Corinth had gone forward, in essence, and said, I am a Christian. But it is in the midst of these real-life situations that their true values and beliefs are emerging. They hate Paul. They love to be seen as wise by the world. They value sexual indulgence. They think highly of their own sophisticated understanding and look down on those who are naive. They think highly of their own sophisticated spiritual gifts and look down on others that don't share them. And they think that the important thing is this world and not the next. Well, we're in the same situation that they were. Not in one sense, we're not. We're not facing the problem of whether we should eat meat sacrificed to idols. Maybe we're not in an environment where tongues are a particular problem. Maybe I don't have the attitude that tongues are the spiritual manifestation the way some of the Corinthians did. Maybe I, you know, after 2,000 years of the church talking about the resurrection, even the most nominal Christian has figured out what Christians believe in is resurrection. So, okay, so we'll buy that. Sure, resurrection, great. But we face the same pressures. We face the same issue in a variety of different ways. Is what I see in this world really what's going to satisfy me? Or is there something else going on? Is there room for God in my picture of the world? And is there room for you in my picture of the world? Do I recognize that God has stepped into my life and changed the parameters of things greatly? I don't live in the same world I used to live in before I came to understand who God was. That everything's different now. And that includes where I'm headed and the purpose of what I'm doing now and the value of what I'm doing now and your place in my life, the importance of you as people that I need to respect and care about, both as believers and just as human beings. That's what we have been called to. So even though many of the issues in Corinth may not be issues that we're facing specifically, really we are. What is the true wisdom? What do I do with my freedom? I mean, those are all questions that we face. What is the point of life? Where is this all going? What gives me value as a human being? All of those questions are addressed by the things that Paul talks about in this letter. And if there's a certain amount of repetitiveness to the points that I've made as we go through the letter, I think it's because in the end the issue comes back to the same thing. Is this stuff true or not? Is there a God who has made the call on my life that the Bible says that he has, or not? If there is, then life is like this. If there isn't, then life is like this. But the worst thing you can do is say, yes, there is, and then live as if this were the way life is, which is what was happening in Corinth. I say yes to God, and I say no to God with everything that I choose to do and believe in my life. My understanding is that that's what we're facing now. That's what life is about. I know many people now who face various struggles. In fact, it's getting to the point where sometimes I'm reeling from the phone rings and I think, what terribly tragic, difficult circumstance am I going to hear about now? I mean, I think if I was to explore with every one of you, you could tell me stuff that I would end up, I don't think I even want to hear the rest of the story. I mean, all of us are facing pressures of various kinds. But what strikes me as I look around and I think about the situations that I face and the people around me face, that fundamentally it comes back to these issues again. Because it may not be possible for us to solve the circumstances of that are bringing suffering into our lives or the lives of the people around us. We just may not be able to make it go away. But the question is, what world do I live in when I'm facing those sufferings? Do I live in a world where God is good and all things work together for good and I have a hope that gives me courage in the face of the things that are coming my way, or don't I? That's the struggle that we face. I think that's what this whole deal is about, why God didn't just beam us up when we became believers and move on to the next step. This is the opportunity for us to face into these questions. Is God good and to be trusted or not? That's what Paul was confronting the Corinthians with over and over again in these various problems. And I think that's what we're facing now. So, I mean, my admonition to you is the same admonition that I give myself. I so often think that my problem is my problem, the thing that's in front of me. But my real problem is, will I face the life that I have now as a believer, or will I face it as an unbeliever? That's the question in front of me. And I think that's what Paul was confronting them with, and I wish I could tell you that there's some magic wand I could wave to solve your problem, but I don't think that's true. I think you're going to have to face the question just the way they did. What's life about? Is there a God? Where is this going? Okay. I thought it would be appropriate for me to end my session in 1 Corinthians by being late, since I was late in most of the times I talked. I can't end without giving you at least one or two opportunities to say something or ask some sort of question. So even though we're late, I'll make it brief. I promise we won't go very long. We don't have much time, but if you do have something you'd like to say or ask. I see Logan's hand and then Margaret over here.
The admonition to let them be anathema.
Mm-hmm.
Let them. Is he saying realize they are, or is he saying don't try to talk them out of it?
No, it's not let. That sort of let is not the permit kind of let. It's more like, if you translate it, like, may they be anathema or something like that. It's that we don't have a handy way of translating that sort of stuff. It's a third person imperative. You know, usually an imperative is second person, you do this. Well, third person imperatives are them do this. They are to do this. And usually the point of a third person imperative is to tell me, the person that you're talking to, something. I mean, they are not here, but I'm talking to you. So the idea is, what he's saying to these people is, my attitude towards them is, may they be anathema. They are to be seen as unaccepted. Not unaccepted as people or unaccepted as worthy of respect or something like that, but unaccepted as believers, unaccepted as being a part of those who have put their hope in God. You're telling me that you're on God's side, but you don't like Jesus. Well, I don't buy it. I mean, you may be on some God's side, but you're not on the God side of the God who made the world. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that's the idea. Yes, the idea is basically, this is how you should think about such a person. You don't want to be one of those, and you don't want to pretend that it doesn't make a difference with someone who is one of those. That's what he's saying. But we don't want it to make the wrong sort of difference. You don't want to take this, I just reiterate, this is not, I want to go out and be snotty to people who aren't believers. You know, you're dirt because I'm a believer and you're not. No, 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 no. But it makes a difference. Okay.
I have a question about authority. He was talking about Stephanus, you know, submit yourself to him and that kind of thing. And one of the issues that came up frequently in Corinthians is people who are not submitting themselves to Paul's authority. I was having a conversation with a young friend the other day who has a bit of a fascination, I guess, with some of the more larger, more traditional denominations, Catholicism and Orthodoxy and that kind of thing. And he made the comment that he thought one of our problems was our unwillingness to submit to authority. And I guess I just kind of snorted and said, well, what authority? Which one should I choose to submit myself to? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, the Reformation sure took care of that, didn't they? And I said, oh, you can only say that out of an ignorance of history. If you knew anything about the Catholic history, you could find, 10 bishops with 11 different opinions about any particular subject among them. There was no unified authority there. And it would change from pope to pope and that kind of thing. So one of the things that I periodically think about is, I agree one should submit oneself to a true authority, but are there any authorities nowadays? How do we recognize them? How should the Corinthians have recognized Paul as an authority? And maybe that would answer the question about how we recognize authorities these days.
Right. Well, I think Jack likes to make the distinction between an ordinary authority and absolute authority, that sort of thing. Maybe that would be helpful to start with, is the sort of authority that Paul was claiming as an apostle was, what I'm speaking is the truth, especially as we find it in the scriptures. What the scriptures tell us is the truth. And when we have understood what it is telling us, this is what God is telling us about the way things are. So I submit to that authority because it is rational for me, if it's true that there is a God and that he has communicated through the apostles and so on an understanding of life, then it's appropriate for me to submit to that, to find out what it's saying and to live in the light of it, because it is appropriate for me to pursue what's true. There's another issue of authority, though, which has to do with the appropriateness of my submitting myself, recognizing that someone has a responsibility for something that I do not have a responsibility for, and bowing to that responsibility. That's not absolute. I mean, there are limits to how far I will go in submitting to that kind of authority. I think that Paul is not saying that Stephanus was an infallible authority to follow, but he was, in fact, a mature believer that Paul recognized as a mature believer who was seeking to lead the church in a way that would be beneficial and promote an understanding of the gospel and so on. And if to resist his authority in that situation was not just, you weren't saying, oh, I believe he might be wrong, but to actually say, no, I don't need to listen to him. I would rather do it my way. I'm going to fight for control and make the church go in a different way. And that sort of thing, where I am both not recognizing the responsibility that he has over the group, and I'm also, in essence, denying that the gospel that he's teaching is, in fact, the truth. If someone in this group was to rise up and say, we don't want to listen to you guys anymore, we think we ought to be doing something like this, it could arise just from, hey, I think your guys' theology is great, but we need a new building program, and you guys are not getting with the program, so we're wrestling control away from you, and now everybody give us your money so we can build a great cathedral or something like that. That could happen. Or somebody could rise up and say, no, you know, we've been thinking about it. This picture of what life is all about that you are painting is not right. There's something else. There's this great, wonderful deal we could have, and we are rising up to say, down with you guys, up with our new picture of the wonderful Christian life we could have. Okay, well, now there's a fundamental, by resisting authority in that sense, what it's saying is, I reject your picture and I'm putting a new one in its place. And with Stephanus, I think that's one of the things that's involved. Stephanus is accurately reflecting what Paul taught, and his opponents are trying to take it in a different direction. So it's not an inviolable authority, but it's an authority that is there by nature, by logically speaking. Stephanus is accurately teaching the gospel, so I ought to submit to him. And Stephanus is rightly a mature believer that has responsibility over the group, so we ought to let him do what he has the responsibility to do. And if he goes way out of line, then we stop listening to him and we take corrective action. Okay, we went real late. Thank you. I don't know what we're doing next week. We're not doing 1 Corinthians, I can tell you that.